everyone. Welcome to Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. This week, the Running Dialogue is going to be about Alice in Wonderland and Tim Burton, 3D, and things related to those things. My name is Kurt Holman. I write for Creative Loafing newspaper in Atlanta. And with me is...
My name's Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com.
And I've gleaned here that we have a little bit of disagreement about Alice in Wonderland. I haven't talked to Russ very much about it yet. But I'll say that I like it with some reservations. Russ, I would say, dislikes it with no reservations. Is that a fair assessment?
I think I hated everything about this movie.
Yeah.
Everything. Not everything. There are a couple of small moments where the performances weren't bad. But yeah. Otherwise, I didn't see the point, and I was not at all taken with it.
Yeah. Well, let's first talk about how the premise of this is different than the usual Alice. And in a way, it reminded me a little bit of the Sherlock Holmes movie with, you know, because it's presented as kind of like a sequel to the Alice in Wonderland story, and Sherlock Holmes comes in kind of on the back end of the Sherlock Holmes mythos. And in both cases, it takes like a famous Victorian protagonist and basically makes them a Hollywood action hero.
Right.
So,
right.
And in this one, Alice, whose last name I believe is Kingsley in this story, is a 19-year-old girl who believes she had dreams about Wonderland when she was six, which may have actually been real, but she just thinks they're dreams, and is about to get married to this sort of stuff shirt, you know, snob, and at the party kind of sees the rabbit and runs off and goes into Wonderland, which the inhabitants say is actually called Underland, and discovers that the Red Queen is... has this tyrannical rule, and she's kind of like both the Red Queen from Through the Looking Glass and the Queen of Hearts, who's the off with their heads ones from the first book. And so Alice is sort of like, you know, the classic hero having to, like, you know, rally all these people and defeat the Red Queen. So,
and discovering she's the chosen one.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
The most important. Yeah.
Except that she's not a classic hero or a classic heroine because she doesn't have anything to do. She just kind of runs around looking at stuff, and she's relatively passive. She, you know, it's kind of like, I guess the core thing is what is the story here? What is actually going on? You know, okay, so Alice shows up. She's told, hey, you're Alice. You're back. This is rad. And she's like, I don't know. Am I Alice? Am I back? What are you talking about? And that's kind of the mode through a bunch of the movie. And then she discovers that she has to, you know, take part in this battle and doesn't really get it and doesn't really want to. And nobody else really seems to care all that much.
One of the things that's kind of distracting about it is because so many of the characters are Lewis Carroll characters who are basically crazy, or they follow their own logic, and they speak in this kind of made-up lingo that might be based on actual obscure Lewis Carroll poems. It might be just made-up lingo.
I think, you know, a lot of it is actually based on Carroll dialogue.
Yeah, yes.
But... which, you know, I'm passingly familiar with, so there's a lot of stuff I recognized, and I assume that much more of it comes from deeper in that.
Yeah, yeah. So so it's, like, hard to tell, you know, or, like, the Tweedledee and Tweedledum, how crazy are they, how crazy is the March Hare? And it's, like, if they're sort of, like, you know, the 3PO and R2-D2 in this hero's journey, just how useful are these characters, you know?
I would say that no one in this film is useful. Everyone directs Alice what to do. Alice kind of does it and figures out simplistic means to achieve her goals. Nothing particularly clever. She, at one point, she's trying to convince the Red Queen that she's not Alice because she's taller than she should be, and she's, my name's from Umbridge.
Yeah.
And later, one of the things that actually confused me at that point is there's this scroll or compendium, and it tells the future, and it shows Alice slaying the Jabberwocky. And the Red Queen's like, I know that mess of tangled hair anywhere. And so she recognizes Alice. When she actually meets Alice, she doesn't think it's Alice.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's weird things like that that tell me it's not a very clever movie. And what I came away thinking from Alice in Wonderland was this is a film that Tim Burton thinks is imaginative, which, A, it's not, because we all expect it from him. And the whole point of imagination or good imagination is you come up with new ideas, and this could have been, this is Tim Burton's journal from hell, how long ago, of his designs and kooky dark stuff that's kind of twisted but wonderful. And but and just to finish up the idea, what now I can't remember where I was going with the idea. continue I'm sorry. Well,
I want to jump in on that. So there's, you know, Alice shows up and there's a prophecy scroll, and it shows these things that are going to happen. A logical thing for the villain of the piece, who discovers that there's a prophecy scroll, scroll that shows the things that are going to happen, would be to try to prevent those things from happening.
But
would be to try to, you know, so that later on, okay, so the prophecy scroll shows that Alice is eventually going to do battle with this creature and that you're going to lose. So why, when the time comes, does she send that creature out? Why doesn't she try to subvert the scroll?
Well,
why doesn't she try to?
I don't know if the scroll actually said she was going to lose. It just showed Alice fighting the Jabberwockies. So, but, and the other thing is, like, you know, very early on, there are people searching for Alice with the, you know, the Red Queen's, you know, armored playing cards and the, you know, massive canine Bandersnatch running off. So it's not like she's not looking for them.
No. I understand
that. Yeah. And her character, the Red Queen, you know, played by Helena Bonham Carter with a giant, giant head, it's, I think, persuasively presented as being so kind of crazy, you know, that inconsistencies didn't bother me so much with her because she's not like Darth Vader. I mean, she's easily distracted and petty, you know. So those things didn't bother me so much. You know?
She was the Red Queen is one of the only characters that was recognizable as anything, you know. And that's kind of where I was going with that. Is like, ultimately, there's a lot of people running around, and I really couldn't tell what any of them wanted. You know, her, the Red Queen's henchman, is this sort of strangely elongated, tall, kind of evil knight played by Crispin Glover.
Who I actually liked in the film.
Who's kind of like, yeah, he was okay. And I don't know, was kind of weirded out with the fact that it was Crispin Glover's head on some weird CGI body that didn't make any sense.
It did seem like he was a lot taller and muscular than I remember.
Because
with him, just to throw in, it's like, it's not that he's like a giraffe or anything.
No.
He's just really unusually long torso, and it's like, why is his torso? That's really weird.
But he's very obviously animated as well. The way the character moves is unnatural, and I couldn't tell if it was just crappy animation or if it was supposed to tell me something about him. And I couldn't figure out what he was doing. It's like, what does he want? He's just bad.
Yeah.
You know, which to me is kind of the classic wrong way. You know, if you want to run, if you want to write an evil character, that person doesn't think they're evil.
Yeah.
You know, that person does stuff that is important to them. And I could kind of tell what was important to the Red Queen. I could kind of tell what she wanted to do. I couldn't tell with Crispin Glover's character. I couldn't tell with a bunch of the characters in the movie.
I thought he was sort of a sycophant. That's not to say that he's definitely bad first, but
yeah. But so, does he want power? Does he have like some sort of design? What is he trying to accomplish in this thing? And you can never tell. It's just kind
of that's sort of a character 101 thing. What does this character want?
I would say with that character, in kind of the framing device that sets, I guess, in kind of the Victorian London at this engagement party, we see Alice's sister and her husband, and her husband's flirting with this Chippy, off behind the hedges.
He's doing more than flirting.
Yeah. So, and just you saying that makes me think that the Knave of Hearts, or who I think is called Stain in the story, might be kind of like him, you know.
Right.
He's sort of like, he's just, you know, doing these appearances of being loyal to the Queen, but is actually trying to get some of his own, on the corners, or when he gets a chance. But my point of entry in this is, as someone who knows the books and adaptations of the books fairly well, is that the books are very episodic, and Alice is almost completely passive in it until like maybe the end of the first one, and maybe not so passive but through the Looking Glass. So the movies can be very episodic, and they don't have a lot of narrative through line or arcing or anything like that. It's just set piece, set piece, set piece, set piece. And some of them will be great, and some of them will be tedious, and some of them might not be great at all, you know. So I can appreciate having them make Alice a lot more active, a more conventional active thing than in that, you know, because it's like, well, I think they would have to do something to make her more active. And so to me, it's like a Neil Gaiman-y kind of riff on Alice that's as much Joseph Campbell as it is Lewis Carroll, you know, where she's got to, like, get the Vorpal Sword, and Jabberwocky, the poem, here becomes, like, the prophecy story almost. And there's a point when, like, the Mad Hatter gets captured, but they want her to go to the White Queen, and she says, no, I want to go rescue the Mad Hatter, where she makes kind of a turn and starts being a lot more active and stuff like that. And another thing in Alice is that people, a lot of times, they spin it as a quintessential coming-of-age story, which right. It doesn't always fit, but things like Pan's Labyrinth and Spirited Away and Coraline are all very, very, you know, Alice in Wonderland-like,
oh, sure.
You know.
Yeah.
So I feel like they do all that coming-of-age story stuff here, and it kind of makes a little bit more sense because she kind of becomes this hero, even though the idea that she becomes a hero is kind of ridiculous. But I kind of liked how she became a hero, and I kind of like the way the White Queen's line, sometimes I believed in as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. That's kind of a running line through the movie that becomes this kind of key moment. I really got into all that stuff. So that's where I went with it.
See, but my problem is that Alice, unlike those other movies that you mentioned, mm-hmm. Alice doesn't seem to be very invested. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really want anything. She doesn't really care because throughout she thinks what's happening is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's a dream, she doesn't want anything. She mm-hmm. feels like she's just going from place to place. Mm-hmm. And even when she decides to go rescue the Mad Hatter, I was thinking, you met this guy in one scene, mm-hmm. and he's sort of wacky, and then mm-hmm. he sort of helped you to go somewhere else, but now you're going to be undermine that entirely by
now
going.
There's kind of an implied romantic relationship yeah. between, like, this budding nascent romantic relationship between them,
which is weird.
I saw that more as being like Dorothy and the Scarecrow's relationship from the Wizard of Oz, which some people can read that into that, but I didn't really see it that way. And there is a part where she, I think it's like the last time she talks to the Alan Rickman caterpillar, mm-hmm. where she becomes aware that Wonderland she actually visited when she was a kid, and she realizes that it's not a dream. So there is a sort of amount of part where it's like, I think this is a dream, so it doesn't matter what I do, where she, you know, kind of takes more charge.
Right, but I don't think that's really, mm-hmm. I think it's too late by that point. Mm-hmm. I remember what I was going to say earlier. Mm-hmm. What's supposed to feel imaginative mm-hmm. lacks any weight because it's not clever.
Mm-hmm.
And those other films you mentioned, there's imagination to them, mm-hmm. but everything in those films that feels, that has sort of that imaginative bent,
mm-hmm.
that twist feels like it serves a purpose, mm-hmm. that there's a symbolism there. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Alice in Wonderland, Tim Burton feels like he's using imagination as an end unto itself, mm-hmm. which bothers me because I feel that while imagination has been a through line through most mm-hmm. of his filmography, mm-hmm. this time it feels like he's just saying, look at all these kooky designs I did mm-hmm. in 3D.
Yeah.
And I feel that the film should just really be called Tim Burton's 3D.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so it's like, look, here's a horse fly mm. on a rocking chair, and yeah. it's going to fly through the screen. Mm. And I'm like, okay, that's all well and good. But so yeah, not only is there a weak plot, mm. for instance, the Vorpal Sword that can defeat the Jabberwocky, mm. they keep it in a room. And I'm looking at Stain, who always has a sword yeah. on him, and I'm thinking, wouldn't it be smarter if he kept the best sword
yeah.
on his person at all times?
Well, it's not just in a room. It's in, like, the doghouse where the Jabberwock is.
The Bandersnatch.
Getting yeah. my, you know, Lewis yeah. Carroll monsters mixed up. But so you can't just walk in and take the Vorpal Sword because the...
But the film does make it look easy.
Yeah.
How she does it. Yeah. There just doesn't seem to be a lot going on there. And you mentioned sort of how Stain mm-hmm. kind of resembles mm-hmm. her brother-in-law mm-hmm. and what he's doing. But when she briefly comes across all these other characters, mm-hmm. it's a vague resemblance, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily an informative resemblance. Mm-hmm. So her imagination mm-hmm. may be informing Underland, which mm-hmm. I didn't know was German. That was surprising to me. It's Wunderland.
Okay, well, I'll go with that.
No, it's not German. I just thought it was so weird that it's actually called Underland, whatever. Unless that's from the books.
Not to my knowledge. Okay. Yeah.
But it's not. It doesn't feel any deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And even when you do make those connections, they feel very loose rather than she is taking one experience from another. Because there are other characters in the real world that don't
have an analog in Underland.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you've got the – yeah, I mean initially when she's in, quote, unquote, the real world, you see there are two – girls who sort of loosely correspond to Tweedledum and Tweedledee. There's, her
mother-in-law to be is very much like the Red Queen.
Right.
You know,
and then, so there may be four characters that have these correspondences to Wonderland, or Underland, but that's sort of where it ends. And it's kind of like, okay. I don't need the imagination to be tethered to anything. Mm-hmm. I don't need the imagination to be justified. I just need it to be interesting. Mm-hmm. And I need it to capture my imagination. Mm-hmm. And seeing, like you say, like a unicorn in on a bicycle or something, mm-hmm. and like these flowers that have faces, mm-hmm. and they're talking and all this, it just seemed forced and not... There was no idea in it that did anything for me. You know, it's like I can take Terry Gilliam's crazy, mm-hmm. sort of weird flights of fancy that are really kind of untethered to reality and untethered to anything, and I get you know, sort of enchanted by those. But the stuff here, I was just I didn't. There's nothing in it that made me want to keep watching it.
See,
I will say, just to jump in on that, though, I think some of the things look like, you know, well, it's Alice in Wonderland, so we've got to have a certain number of things, like the you know, rocking horse fly and things like that. But some of the things, like most of the Red Queen's animal attendants, like the frogs that are like lined up, and like the monkeys who are like. Use it basically holding up stuff to be like chairs and tables and things like that.
That was kind of cute.
So I thought it was a little inconsistent. Some I liked a lot more than others.
Yeah.
You know.
No, those touches in the Red Queen's palace were kind of neat. You know, you've got these. Yeah, all the furniture is animals holding up. Like, so a table is, you know, a couple of monkeys holding up a tabletop, or like. You can see in the corner of one shot, there's a chandelier that's these like three birds struggling to hold a chandelier.
Yeah, and they're all straining.
And they're really straining. Yeah, and it's like, okay, that's kind of neat. And more of that would have been good. And
I just feel with imagination, I feel that it's Tim Burton's through line from Edward Scissorhands, where that character, and this is just maybe my interpretation of most of his filmography, is he likes to explore imagination as the duality of it. Mm. There's this sort of bright, happy side that everyone likes, and then there's a darker side that not everyone's willing to accept, and they want to walk away. Yeah. And I feel his films kind of keep exploring that, how that flips together, and what people want out of imagination, and what they might not like out of it. And
none of that is even vaguely present here.
Exactly. There's no idea. Alice in Wonderland, I don't feel that there's anything to it. Mm-hmm. And I feel that that's been the case since Big Fish. I love Big Fish. Yeah. And I think Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is really bad, and Sweeney Todd, which doesn't have that idea, but it feels like I'm Tim Burton and I should do Sweeney Todd.
Well, remember though, I think you can probably make a case that nearly all of his films have some kind of imaginative protagonist who's an outsider, who's either an artist who's creative but misunderstood, or some kind of villain or murderer who is, you know, justly, you know, alienated. So you have like your Sweeney Todds and your Jokers and your Penguins and your Oswald Cobblepots, and you have your Edward Scissorhands and your Ed Woods and Jack Skellington, the Pumpkin King, and your Willy Wonkas and things like that. So, and Alice in this is in that tradition of the artist, because they present her very early on as being imaginative and a nonconformist and a feminist in a way, because in like one of her first scenes, her mother discovered she's not wearing a corset or stockings, you know.
And she complains about it being
restricted. And at the end, not to give too much away, she's not put in, even though she's kind of ends up being away from this kind of repressive Victorian society, she's kind of rewarded at the end and is going out into the world and isn't kind of like Edward Scissorhands, who's kind of put off by himself alone, you know. She's, you know, triumphant and, you know, going on an adventure and things like that. Sure. So I thought it kind of took his usual thing and put a neat spin on it, especially because I don't think any of its film's protagonists have been women.
But
so.
she does that by doing exactly. I mean, everything. The ironic thing is she earns her outsider status in the real world by doing every damn thing she's told to do in the fantasy world. Yeah. I mean, it's like everything she does in Wonderland is prefigured, and there's never any sense that she can do anything else. Mm-hmm. She doesn't surprise anyone. She doesn't do anything that no one expects. Mm-hmm. The closest thing that she does that is sneaking into the Red Queen's court by lying about who she is, and then she only does that because the Red Queen is an idiot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like she doesn't actually make any decisions that make her an interesting character. Mm-hmm. She gets there. She's told she's Alice. She's told she's going to do this. Mm-hmm. She spends the whole movie being like, "Well, I don't really have to do that because this is just a dream," mm-hmm. and then she realizes, "Oh no, okay, it's not a dream. So I guess I'll do the stuff that people just told me to do." Mm-hmm. And then she does it, and she goes home. Yeah. And it's kind of like, all right.
Well, another thing, though.
I think we're getting to the impasse part of this discussion.
Although, yeah. Okay. Well, one of the things I do want to talk about, though, since we're talking about Alice, is how heartbreaking it was for me to see Mia Wasikowska, who plays Alice, just an awful performance. Just very flat and stilted. And I wanted to go back to her performance on In Treatment, the HBO series, where she was just so good, and I had such high hopes, and she just feels completely lost. Not in the way she's supposed to feel lost, but it doesn't feel like she knows how to deliver any of these lines.
I would the shorthand I would use for this is Amidala in Wonderland. Mm. It felt very much like the Star Wars prequels. Mm. It feels very, very incompetently staged. There's a lot of stuff where there's a whole bunch of people kind of standing around while two people are talking. Mm-hmm. And I really did get that sense of watching one of those Star Wars prequels, mm-hmm. and get the sense that she is a much better actress than you can see here, but that she's just kind of like, what did she have to hold on to during the making of this film? What did she have to actually give her
that's
a
what
purpose?
I'm thinking.
Liked her in this. I thought that she was not overwhelmed by all the effects and her co-stars. And she reminded me of a younger Claire Danes or Martha Plimpton in a way, you know. So there are parts where she's doing that kind of passive Alice thing where maybe she could have brought more to it, been directed to do more to it. But I got into her a lot more than that. So yeah. I don't agree with that.
Yeah. And the sad thing is that Helena Bonham Carter has some wonderful line delivery. There's some places where she's spot on, perfect, and actually gives the character something, and where she is this kind of like shrill and she's like she's the little sister. She's like the shrill and demanding and ignored and petulant kid that occasionally those cracks show, and you get to see where she's like, yeah, I don't actually really know why I'm doing this. I'm just kind of doing it because I do it. Yeah. And she's kind of good in a few moments, which was nice. And Alan Rickman is really good as the voice of the caterpillar, but it's just because he's Alan Rickman. Yeah. And he could voice
anything.
We were talking about there's a remake of the movie, the Dudley Moore movie Arthur, coming around, and which sounds just like a terrible idea. And in part because the one saving grace of that movie, I thought, was John Gielgud's performance, because he's so magnificently condescending. And actually, just occurs to me now that Alan Rickman might be a lot of fun to play the Gielgud role, though it's supposedly Meryl Streep.
But one thing I wanted to say that I thought, as someone who liked the film, is that I didn't find it very funny, and I didn't find it very warm. So, and I would have liked it to have been funnier. There are parts where I'm not sure how funny they wanted to be, because it's just kind of crazy. And it would have been nice if it would have been a little bit more warm, and like you feel affection for these characters. And some of them are like, you know, practically refugees in the situation. It's hard to know what the tone is. Mm-hmm. But so it didn't quite nail everything about it that I thought it would, that it could, you know, even as someone who's on the side of it, you know.
There was a point in his career around Beetlejuice and even later where, through Ed Wood, where Tim Burton could do this really intriguing and surprisingly effective blend of comedy and sort of fear and characters that are really angry and sort of boxed in. And that was always neat. And you kind of see him trying to do that here, like with the Mad Hatter, who is a really odd character. He's this kind of like he's sort of like the Mad Hatter cross with Che Guevara or something.
It's hard to get a bead on what he's about.
And he takes on a Scottish accent when he gets angry.
Yeah, it's weird. He like goes between this lisp and this like angry Scotsman thing. Yeah. And it's I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't understand what was supposed to be happening. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Burton is trying to nail that again, get that blend of comedy and sort of intimidation and fear and these things that really made Beetlejuice kind of so interesting and have made other movies of his so much fun. And it just he just doesn't get it at all, and it just becomes cold and weird and really off-putting and
So one thing that My impression of it was that comparing the 3D of this movie to the 3D of Avatar, Avatar seemed to be less intent on like throwing or thrusting things at the audience in conspicuous ways, and this movie was kind of all out with that. But since I liked it and it was Alice in Wonderland, it's like, well, that seems kind of like it sort of fits this intentionally artificial dreamlike environment. So that was kind of cool that like teacups and hats were constantly like flying out of me with this.
The 3D didn't really bother me,
mm-hmm. but at the same time, it feels like it's from a director who this is my first 3D movie and has no control over what should be restrained and what should be forced out into the audience. And there were some things that didn't really bother me coming out of the screen. But it did feel like Tim Burton came together and he's like, look at my imagination. And now look at it in 3D. Look at the glory I am about to unleash upon you. And it's just like, okay, guy, just let's take a few steps back. Go to a story. Tell me what someone wants.
Well, and it has to be said that the movie wasn't shot in 3D. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, this is one of those post-production conversions. Mm-hmm. And doesn't look that great. It doesn't look super horrible, but underlying the fact that I'm unimpressed with the 3D was the fact that I wasn't impressed with the designs of Wonderland. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of kind of – I saw a lot of people's faces sort of weirdly made up and then superimposed onto these CGI blobs, and none of the look was very intriguing to me across the board. Mm-hmm. So the 3D was just another layer of stuff, and I didn't hate it for being 3D, but it also didn't bring anything to the table, and it didn't make Wonderland more wonderful.
Yeah. How people are talking about, like, since Avatar is such a big hit, it's like, you know, well, so is 3D going to be, like, the big wave of the future and things like that? And it's like, I think, and obviously tons of movies are being made in 3D or released in 3D, you know, now. And I wonder, like, so when is, like, a big 3D movie going to, like, actually take a bath and then people will step back from that, you know? Well,
maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's – I think it's going to take a couple of failures. But I'll be curious to see between this and Clash of the Titans, which was also not shot in 3D but was converted to 3D in post-production.
And the conversion process isn't super expensive. If you have a big blockbuster movie, then giving it the 3D treatment is not going to double its budget. I think the up-convert cost for Clash is something like $8 million,
which
is
huge.
Pocket change compared to the cost of the whole film.
Right, yeah. I mean, if you're already spending, you know, $200 million between production and advertising and everything else.
Granted, they did. The Warner Brothers just did it. They looked at it and made sure that they were impressed by it. They didn't just like, let's do the 3D thing. We don't know how to do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Do it now. And so
let's do Valentine's Day in 3D, you know.
Right. Yeah. right.
I have always wanted to be hated in three dimensions.
Yeah.
But that's life, isn't it?
I think that there's going to be I'll be curious. I guess I'll be really curious to see how this film does financially. And I don't have any bead on where it's going to go. I don't have any bead on how people are going to respond to it. We saw it with an audience and I didn't get the sense that the audience was particularly taken with the movie.
They applauded at the end, though.
Did they?
Yeah.
I left as soon as I could.
I think people are really excited about it and interested in it. And it's like, and Tim Burton whether you like him or not, has almost always made popular movies.
Yeah.
You know,
he has an audience, yeah. and Alice has an audience. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people this week who've, you know, it's always interesting to see what movie people ask you about, what they just kind of cold ask you about, rather than saying like, "Hey, what have you seen that's good?" You know, you'll get those questions. Oh, well, no, how is this? And certainly, a lot of people have been asking about Alice, so there's a high awareness and a high interest in it.
Yeah, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, like reviewers were like, "We don't like a lot of things about it," but it did quite well, you know. So I think it'll do surprisingly well. I mean, I think of how much you think it'll do. It'll probably do better than that.
Oh.
You
know?
So, I'm interested to see the legs on it.
No, it's something you think it should do.
I think it'll do Zizek's Road numbers.
Yeah. Right.
And that is the most
The thing with this having legs or not is that there's the whole question of whether or not it will be allowed to, because there's the whole there's the 3D screen crunch, because there are only so many 3D screens in the world. I was going to say in the US, but in the world, period. And you've got this opening this week, and you've got 4 weeks until Clash of the Titans opens. And there's some other 3D stuff coming around. So, and plus, I mean, Avatar is still going strong. Mm-hmm. So,
How to Train Your Dragon opens before the week
right.
before
How,
that,
How to Train Your Dragon opens at the end of this month, and then Clash of the Titans after that. So, you've only got this movie's only got 3 weeks where it really owns those screens. And so even if it does really well, it kind of has a weird force out, on whatever the 25th.
But it also has a planned force out because of the because it's not going to be released as long as it normally would. Isn't that the deal?
Yeah.
So it can be out on video sooner.
Disney is attempting to shorten. You know, there's this whole debate in the distribution aspect of the business, or the exhibition aspect of, you know, how long the theatrical window on a movie should be. And exhibitors want it to be of, you know, a certain length, whereas studios want it to be a lot shorter because it's easier for them a lot of times to make money on DVD. So I know Disney has been talking about shortening the theatrical window for Alice. But whether that was really something that they wanted to do, or whether that was, you know, them looking at the writing on the wall and seeing, well, we're going to have one anyway because of Clash of the Titans and these other movies, so let's just use this as the guinea pig for an experiment we've been wanting to do anyway, and something we've been wanting to sort of shove down exhibitor throats for years. So this is sort of the opportune time. Regardless, this doesn't get a lot of time in theaters. Yeah. It will be on DVDs sooner rather than later. Beyond that
window keeps getting shorter anyway. You have the window right now seems to be about 4 months. Or 16 weeks is, I think, the
official.
Something
like that.
Something like that,
yeah.
But the number keeps getting shorter. There was a huge fuss last year about how quickly G.I. Joe went from theaters to DVD, and exhibitors weren't happy. But I haven't been hearing that about Sherlock Holmes, which will hit DVD, I think, exactly 3 months after it was in theaters. Like, it came out on Christmas Day, and it's going to be on DVD at the end of March.
Yesterday, I got a review copy of the Princess and the Frog DVD, which I was not expecting, and it's like,
yeah, I got
good
that
Lord,
yesterday,
you know? But this was just out, you know? So, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. If I didn't have to go see movies, I would probably see very few movies and just wait till them come out on DVD, because it's like,
I feel completely differently. I would much rather see stuff in the theater. In part just because I'm always working and I'm always doing different things, and it's way too easy for me to say, oh, I'm going to put this movie on while I'm writing something, and then I'm not paying proper attention to either thing. And it's way too easy for me to get distracted, you know. It's like there's a, you know, I was on a completely different tack from Alice in Wonderland. I was talking about the film Enter the Void, which is Gaspar Noé's new movie, total crazy art house movie. And ironically a bit Wonderland-like from what I understand of the film. But in a lot of markets, it's going to hit video on demand relatively soon. And I don't want to watch it at home on demand. You know, I want to go to a theater and see it in a theater. And more often than not, that's how I would like to see a film. It's why, like, you know, Matt, you skipped the screening of The Crazies last week because the deadline was too short. You know, you weren't going to have enough time to write about it. Whereas I was like, well, if I don't go see it in a theater, I'm never going to watch it. You know?
See, and I'm okay with never watching it. But I think for – and I hate to – generalize and say most people, but I see the appeal of waiting for the DVD, because what we have here is this climate where you pay $10 to see a movie. You sit through at least 20 minutes of ads before the movie even starts. You have rude people who feel it's okay to text on their cell phone, even talk on their cell phones during the movies, bring kids to movies they shouldn't be at. One of my best moments or favorite moments was I paid to see Crank 2, midnight showing, family there with their kids, like a little baby even.
Let's
at
bring
Crank
our baby
2,
to Crank 2 high
with like, and then like a 3-year-old old and a 7-year-old, and I after the film I really wanted to ask, like, so what do you guys think of Crank 2? But and so I definitely see the appeal of, well, instead of going through all that hassle, why not just stay at home and enjoy it there. Perhaps part of Avatar's success is people think, okay, I can't wait for this to come home because that experience won't transfer. So in order to enjoy this experience, I must go pay the extra money to see it in 3D and wait in line.
Well, what I'm saying is that the experience never transfers. Mm-hmm. It's never as good. I'm not saying that everybody else should feel this way, but I mean,
no, I definitely agree with you on this.
Never as good as it is at home. I'm lucky enough to be in a position where I can see movies in a way that I don't have to deal with a lot of those distractions that people have to, you know, who are going on a Friday night have to deal with. In part, I've also tried to put myself in that position.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, obviously not everybody can do that. And, you know, by not everybody, I mean 99.5% of the people out there can't do it. But, you know, so all I'm saying is for me, yeah, I would much rather see it in a theater, much rather see something presented properly. And for me, properly means on a big screen.
Yeah.
Has to do with where this conversation originated, yeah. I actually don't know.
Yeah, it originated with the DVD release window of Alice.
Right.
But I do want to say that, like, you know, I obviously agree that that's the ideal situation to see a movie. But just as a critic, if I see a movie on a screen or see a movie in a theater, I don't think it makes that much more difference because the movie itself is the same. And so there are movies that I saw on screener last year that were, like, some of my favorite films of that year, like Anvil, the story of Anvil, you know, or things like that, you know. So
it makes a difference, because if I don't like a movie or if there's something that, you know, it's far easier for me to be distracted if I'm watching on a screener on a, you know, much smaller screen at home. There's movies that if I go to a theater that I can pay complete and undivided attention to,
sure,
even if I'm not in love with the movie, which in the long run does more justice to the film, because maybe there's something late in the game that'll change my mind. Whereas, you know, watching on a screener, if it's a little dodgy in the first two reels, I start to tune out and maybe I'll check my email and all that. And, you know, that's my own weakness, but, you know, it's a weakness that I acknowledge and understand, and I try to work around by actually seeing things in the theater more than on screeners. So,
okay,
I guess we should
wrap it up and do our recommendations.
Yes, the film I'd like to recommend is a documentary that came out last year called Every Little Step, and it just came to Netflix Watch Instantly. And this was my favorite documentary of last year. It was one of my favorite films of last year. What it's about is it's a documentary about A Chorus Line. Part of the documentary...
The Broadway musical.
A Chorus Line, yes. And part of the documentary is about the creation of the actual musical in the 70s and the competition between performers to get into the revival, which is such a perfect aspect to focus on, because A Chorus Line is about an audition. And as a musical, I don't really like A Chorus Line. I think it's overwrought. I think the speeches ring very hollow and forced. I think it's a dancer's musical. And I can't appreciate it on a level of the complexity and of the dance moves, but the only memorable tune in there for me is One. And beyond that, there's not a lot I really like about that musical. Mm-hmm. I appreciated that musical so much more mm-hmm. after seeing Every Little Step, because Every Little Step seems to understand that drama mm-hmm. that the actual musical is missing.
It gets A Chorus Line better than, you know, the Richard Attenborough adaptation of The Chorus Line got.
Right. Yeah. I saw A Chorus Line mm-hmm. when it was at the Fox mm-hmm. last year, and seeing these emotions of real people and that complete commitment. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I feel is so impressive when you become an actor or performer. And the thing about A Chorus Line is you have to have the whole package. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to act, you have to be able to sing, and you have to be able to dance. Mm-hmm. Dancing and the dance required of mm-hmm. A Chorus Line is insane. Mm-hmm. And so to have that trifecta, mm-hmm. you're rooting for these people to get in. Mm-hmm. When you see it on stage, the whole thing is this off-screen casting, the off-screen director mm-hmm. is telling these people auditioning, do you want to mm-hmm. tell me something about your mm-hmm. life? And that's how I'm going to know. And, of course, this leads into musicals mm-hmm. and their history. But all of it seems to ring a little phony. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this documentary drew me in so much when I didn't actually like the musical it was about was just incredible, and I can't recommend it enough. So if you have Netflix, check it out. I don't know if it's available on DVD as well, but try to see this movie. It's better than all the other documentaries I saw last year.
I'm going to go on the obscure side, as inspired by Alice in Wonderland, to mention another adaptation called, I believe, just Alice. And it's an animated version from a Czechoslovakian animator named Jan Svankmajer.
I hate you because this is what I was going to write.
Oops, you know. Well, you can jump in. We can co-recommend this one then. But Jan Svankmajer is like one of these sort of unsung geniuses. He's from Czechoslovakia and originated when it was under, you know, the Iron Curtain, basically. And does these wild, creepy, visionary, like, stop-motion things. There's a film called Darkness Like Darkness that, if you can find on YouTube, check it out, because it's about 7 minutes long. It's very inventive and imaginative about a body that comes together piece by piece inside a little room with a little light bulb over mm-hmm. it. So, and his Alice in Wonderland version is this very dreamlike version of the story that's basically made of, like, found objects, like taxidermy skeletons. And when Alice, who's played by a real little girl, shrinks, she becomes like a doll, like mm-hmm. moving around this environment. So and it's just like, I mean, it doesn't really have like the narrative through line that I was talking about before, but it doesn't need it because it's just like working on the total dream logic area. And you can tell that this guy really has influenced people like Cary Gilliam and Tim Burton and others. So mm-hmm. what do you have to say about
the thing about that movie is it's this. The animation is both magnificent and incredibly creepy, mm-hmm. and which to me kind of cuts to what underlies a lot of Carol's original stuff. Mm-hmm. Like you've got, I think it's the white rabbit is running around and is, you know, a stuffed rabbit and keeps the watch actually sort of shoved inside his belly mm-hmm. through this rip in the fabric. Mm-hmm. But he's always leaking sawdust mm-hmm. and he's consequently always eating sawdust, eating like these spoonfuls of sawdust, mm-hmm. which then leak back out mm-hmm. of him. And it's like the head of the white rabbit is this kind of like taxidermied mm-hmm. rabbit head. Mm-hmm. And so that animated eating the sawdust mm-hmm. is incredibly bizarre. And
you might not want to watch this with your children.
It's not a kid's movie. Yeah, it's not a kid's movie. It's
unless your kids are awesome.
Yeah. Right. And it's also, I mean, the thing is, it's a little bit of a trial because the way that the movie is constructed, it's sort of like Alice is narrating the story. So there are these frequent, I would say, incessant close-ups on the mouth of the girl who plays mm-hmm. Alice, who's, you know, kind of like, you know, she'll be narrating, and then, in a, you know, such as, a, you know, we're late, said the white rabbit. And every time it says, you know, every time that said the white rabbit line comes up, it's spoken by Alice in this real close-up, and it's kind of distracting and weird. But the animation is so crazy and insane and wild that it's entirely worth entirely worth taking a look at. And it's, to me, it kind of compares to, I think my first exposure to Carol was being given an edition of Alice in Wonderland when I was probably 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. And it's Alice in Wonderland illustrated not by Tennille,
John Tennille, I think,
who's the classic illustrator, but by Ralph Steadman, who's the guy who did, you know, the illustrations for, you know, the classic illustrations for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and all that. I mean, like, wild, psychedelic, super crazy stuff. And I still have this book that's this oversized paperback that I got when I was a child. And if I look in it, it's just deep purple and black crayon colored in everywhere, which sort of suggests how I responded to it as a kid, which was just with utter horror and dismay. But as an adult, I kind of appreciate that aspect of it. And Svankmajer's Alice kind of gets to that same thing and has that same undercurrent of, this is really weird and really kind of uncomfortable. And so, if you have a little bit of patience, it's very much worth checking out, as is pretty much everything that he's done.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, that was us on Alice in Wonderland. And so I'll say, I guess, thanks to Matt and Russ. Do y'all want to introduce yourself again? Or
sure. Thanks for having me on. My name's Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher, and I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, which is www.slashfilm.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/RussFisher, which is RussFisher.
Oh, we're doing Twitter now?
Sure, do Twitter.
All right. I'm on Twitter. Follow me. My name, it's twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
And I'm Kurt Holman of Creative Loafing Atlanta, and I'm on Twitter at Kurt_HOLMAN. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.